If you have a story that you'd like to share, you can do this one of two ways. You can either hit the little voicemail icon on our Spotify page and leave me a brief description with your name, number, and, you know, just the basics. Or you can email me at, get ready for this, it's a terribly long email, aliens, UFOs, and ghost stories at yahoo.com. There's no such thing as a bad story. All stories are welcome. So Ken's a new friend of mine, and we are friends on Facebook, and I was delighted to realize that, Ken, you have a great sense of humor. I don't know if you noticed, but I actually shared one of your posts that you posted on Facebook. It was something about Elon Musk. Do you remember that?
Right. He wanted to buy Coke to put the Coca-Cola to put the Coke back in.
Yeah, it's pretty funny because if for our listeners who might not have heard, he was trying to buy Twitter, and he just seems to be on this. He's just dead set on buying up all these really strange things. But all right, well, we'll get back into it. So Ken, for people who might not know what MUFON is, it's an acronym. What does that acronym stand for?
Mutual UFO Network. It's an organization, actually worldwide organization, that's been around for more than 50 years. And the membership consists of quite a few people with former military, former agency experience, scientists, and consultants from many different fields. And the stated objective of the organization is to study the UFO and ET phenomenon for the benefit of mankind. It is a nonprofit organization. It exists online so that if anyone has a sighting that they'd like to report, they can go to MUFON's online presence, and there's a questionnaire that they can fill out to, you know, put in the date and the time and the direction of flight, how large the object appeared to be, if there were any entities that were viewed, and any other strange phenomena that might have taken place. So if they can't determine that it was something that of a regular nature, you know, aircraft or meteor or satellite, which is most often the case, they assign an investigator to call the person, contact them, whatever contact information they give, to see if they can get additional information. So they keep an archive of all of their cases. And so, you know, they've over the years collected tens of thousands of reports from around the world.
Yeah. So in layman's terms, basically what MUFON does, you know, let's say me, Jake, I'm going out to my car in the middle of the night and I notice a strange object in the sky that I know immediately isn't a plane. And I know very easily and obviously that it's not a helicopter. I may consider contacting MUFON. MUFON investigates these scenarios. And again, like Ken was saying earlier, he was the Texas state director of MUFON, meaning, I mean, obviously Texas is the biggest state within the United States. For him to have headed that is pretty impressive. I believe I got this right, Ken. When you first joined, there was roughly like 40 investigators. And by the time you left, there was about 250. Do I have that right?
No, in the state we had, you had the numbers correct, but there were 25 or 30 members in the entire state. Walt Andrus, the founder of MUFON, actually lived in a small community called Seguin in South Texas. And he and another handful of people had regular meetings, but the Dallas group, the Austin group, the Houston group, there was another group that all kind of fallen by the wayside for lack of management and attention. So whenever I took over the state as director, there were very few active members and just a couple of old stalwarts for investigators. But by the time I left, I had 47, I believe it was, investigators around the state and about 250 or more members in the state. So, you know, it made our membership one of the largest in the world, you know, much less in the country. And certainly a very impressive a group of investigators. Most of my investigators had previous, they were trained observers. They had to go through a training program in order to become investigators to begin with, which was quite an intense course. But many of them already had experience in the military or former police officers. And anyway, they were trained observers and had experience, you know, questioning, observing the mannerisms of witnesses.
Okay. And for anybody who might have missed that, you know, we do this in post, we promote the books, and a lot of times we do it at the head of the show. But again, Mr. Cherry, Ken Cherry, wrote a book called Mark Slade Investigates the Stephenville UFO. It's an outstanding book. If you guys are fascinated in the subject, you need to go buy it. This is a very famous case. I mean, for Michiganders, where we live, you might not be familiar with it. This happened in 2008?
Yeah, 2008. Pardon me, January 8th, 2008. I guess the initial story hit the papers in January the 10th, 2 days later, in 2008. So, I was on a program, NBC Dateline, and they were showing. The name of the show was the 10 top. UFO cases. And I forget, I think Stephenville came in like number two. And so it was certainly considered one of the top ones. When the story broke, it made international headlines, literally. And, you know, I don't want, you don't know how far into the story you want me to get, you know, this early on, but, yeah, it was very, very significant. And I think earlier, the Arizona, the Phoenix Lights had made quite a stir nationally. But I really feel, due to the number of the amount of research we did, the amount of the supporting documentation that we were able to gather, and the amount of witnesses involved, I do think this is a more significant case than the Arizona case. But, you know, Dateline put us right up there together, 2-3, something like that. So,
oh, yeah, absolutely. So, Ken is good friends with Jim Mars. If anybody knows who Jim Mars is, I mean, I would assume that most of you do. But if you don't, he's a very prominent researcher, ufologist from Texas. And he said about the book, an absorbing thriller that presents new insights into the still unexplained events at Stephenville, Texas. Jim wouldn't just do that for anybody. He did it because it's a good book. Do you know what I mean? So guys, if you have any interest in the subject, you really should buy this book. What's the best way they could buy it? Do you have a preferred location that they can go?
No, they can just go to Amazon. If they can't remember the name of the book, they could just go in the search for Ken Cherry and it'll pop up. I think last time I looked, Amazon had changed some of their formatting. I lost about 100 of my reviews, but I think if you read the reviews and what people had to say, for the most part, I got rave reviews. I think one lady was turned off. She said she thought there was a misogynistic statement in there she couldn't get past. But there's no sex. Nothing shady about it. I had to write my book as a novel because what I discovered in my investigation uncovered such a deep, deep conspiracy to hide from the public extraterrestrial or non-terrestrial presence on our planet and this space program that we have and our involvement with ETs and so forth, that I couldn't put the names, many of my the people who came to me were sources, made me promise that I would never use their names. And so a lot of information in my book is from highly respected scientists and people who have direct involvement with some of these secret programs. And so I go into some of those there, and a person who has some knowledge of ufology will recognize a lot of the nuances of my book. But I think there were many people who really were not, deep into the subject and really enjoyed it just as a more or less of a thriller, I guess you might say.
Absolutely. And so in your opinion, Ken, would you consider this a mass sighting, kind of like the Phoenix Lights? I mean, that's my impression.
Yeah, absolutely. Going back to December of 2007, our reporting system was giving us a high number of sighting reports from an area around Stephenville, which is south of Dallas. It's a small community, 18, 20,000 people back then. Primarily, the main industry is dairy there. But a lot of these folks have small dairy farms, and then they work, day jobs because you can't make a living off 8-10 cows, And so they're hardworking, for the most part, older folks, because, a lot of the younger folks move away from these farming communities. And but anyway, we started getting a lot of sighting reports that were pretty similar in late December. Then January 8th, I get a call from an AP reporter. Actually, it was January the 10th. Yeah. And I had worked with her on a number of cases here in Texas that were fairly high profile. But anyway, she called me up and said, "Hey, Ken, there's a story in a little paper down in Stephenville about this sighting these three people had. One of the guys is a pilot. One person works for American Airlines. And they described this enormous craft. And do you find it credible?" And I said, "Yes, I do. And I'm going to send a team down to investigate." Well, she put it on the AP wire, went all over the world. And by the time we got down there, I had 75 witnesses lined up. We couldn't go out and see them all individually. So we had set up a central meeting place. It was a Rotary Club meeting room that was designed to hold about 250 people. I got there and there were 500 people. And most of these were reporters from around the world, literally Japan, England. There was one production crew that said they were filming in New York City. Their boss told them, for one of the networks, and he told them, "Stop what you're doing, get down to Stephenville and, see what's going on with this UFO. And so, I was being called by Larry King and Geraldo and all of these folks who wanted interviews. But at any rate, that's when the international interest began. But even after we took statements from these 75 or so witnesses there, my phone continued to ring for off the hook for months, literally. I stopped counting at over 150 people. Wow. I was in one of the major papers here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, ran the story over the fold 3 or 4 days of 1 week in the, you know, back pages the other days. It was in national magazines. I mean, it was just the amount of publicity that this thing got practically destroyed my business. I was self-employed, and I at one point I had three TV crew outside my house waiting for, you know, their anchors to come in and interview me, and the phone rang constantly. But I stopped counting at over 150 calls. People would call me, you know, because they'd see my name and they'd say, you know, I want to tell you what we saw. And of course, I would dole these out to my investigators to follow up on. But no, we took hundreds and hundreds of statements and calls from people. So it was very much a mass sighting. And Stephenville does have a small college there, but so it's also known as a college town. But interestingly enough, we had no college students. These were what they're primarily, the gray hair folks. You know, we had a few kiddos, but those were, and when I'm talking 10, 12 years old, that were with their parents, though, whose parents saw it, they just happened to be with them. So no, this was middle class, middle aged and older folks. They were very credible. And, you know, a lot of them had grown up in this community. They'd been in the military. They had their careers, and then they came back, you know, to the family farm or whatever. And so there was a lot of, I mean, people get the impression, you know, maybe they live out in the country and a bunch of bumpkins. No, these were, some of them work at a Lockheed defense plant not too far away. So they're, and plus there's military bases. Fort Hood is the largest military base in the country, right next to Stephenville. The president's, Bush's ranch was right next to Stephenville. There's an aircraft manufacturer there, as I said, Lockheed. And so these people were used to seeing aircraft in the air all the time. And some of them had experience working on the aircraft. And as I said, one of the top witnesses we had was an actual pilot. So these people were not a bunch of, you know, rubes who'd never seen anything in the air before. They knew that this was different. And as a matter of fact, we had a lot of law enforcement officers involved as well. Again, trained observers. So there was a lot about this case that made it unique, but it was actually my investigation that was behind the scenes that uncovered really the very sensitive nature of the whole thing that I just had to write a book about, that tried to expose some of the stuff to the public.
Absolutely. And well, I guess the easiest way to say it, just so our listeners can understand what it is that people saw. I mean, how did they describe this craft?
Well, the initial report that made the little Stephenville paper that Steve Allen and a couple of his friends reported, they said they were outside his home or one of their homes. And it was a clear sky, and this craft that went over, he estimated it was about a mile long and a quarter mile wide. And Steve had flown the distance that this thing traveled across the horizon in his plane before. So he had a idea how far it was, and then he just timed how long it took. And he estimated that this craft was flying at 2,000 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah.
Enormous craft. And so they were all standing there kind of aghast, talking, and did we just see what we saw? And a while later, it came back. And this time it was being chased by F-16s. And he said the F-16s were in afterburners. You know, they were giving it everything they had. And he said at some point the UFO said, well, I had enough of this, and went, you know, just left them standing still. Oh, yeah. But they all three witnessed this. And so Steve is a very respected businessman. He owned a large trucking company, quite well known. No one doubted his credibility. And then, of course, this sighting was viewed as it went around about a 4-county area, in an irregular path, was seen by hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. And when you have one person who's highly credible report something, that's meaningful. When you have a group of people together who all say the same thing, that's significant. But when you have people that are spread out over 4 counties, all reporting pretty much the same thing, you know, that is pretty much proof. I mean, you know, it's going to stand up in most courts if you have that many witnesses who don't know each other and they all say the same thing and have no interest in fabricating, then, you know, that is significant. But at any rate, that was the basis of the beginning of our investigation. Over a period of a year, this thing came back numerous times. Mm. And each time we would get, of course, more witness reports. And the last one that was a very large group of witnesses was in October that year. So jump from January to October. That one we tried to keep out of the press because you can't imagine what a menagerie it was with all of these reporters and whack jobs from all, you know, there were people there who were trying to discredit the whole thing and run around town in alien suits and tinfoil hats and, you know, and made it into kind of a carnival atmosphere. So we wanted to avoid that. And, but that was probably, as far as proof was concerned, more significant than, I think we had an 87% correlation between our radar studies, that showed the UFO in the place that the witnesses said at the time that they said. Mm. 87% of the witness stories lined up with the exact location time of the UFO, which was not transponding. It was not a regular aircraft. So anyway.
So for someone who might not understand the significance of that, I mean, it's pretty simple. 87%. That's a big deal. So you mentioned very casually that this happened right over or not far from Lockheed Martin, from a military base. For our listeners who might not understand why they might be interested in Lockheed Martin or a big military base, could you kind of explain historically why they seem to be?
Well, let me let our listeners draw their own conclusion, but I will say that Ben Rich, who was the CEO of Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, that, you know, the Skunk Works was where, is where most of our black budget projects have taken place. Yeah, our most advanced aircraft. Ben Rich was also known as the father of stealth. So the Skunk Works developed the stealth aircraft. At any rate, before Ben Rich passed away, he gave a lecture to a group of engineers. And actually, I know one of the people who attended the talk. And in it, Ben Rich said, "We have the technology to take ET home, and yes, it would not take light years." Like Einstein said, that there was a flaw in the formula. And so Jan Harzan, who had actually and a number of years back, it was the international director of MUFON, was an engineer, and he was in attendance of that talk. And he said he followed Ben out. Ben grabbed his stuff, you know, after the lecture, and he was headed to his car. And he followed him out, and he said, Ben, he said, did you mean what you said, you know, that we have the technology to take ET home? And he said, yes, we do. And he said, wouldn't be brought out to save mankind, you know. Now, I don't recall exactly the way Jan put this, but I'll kind of try to paraphrase it. But he asked him, how is it possible, you know, this speed can exceed the speed of light? And he said, how fast is the speed of thought? That's what Ben said.
Interesting.
And he's so, you know, you can think about being on Jupiter and being there. And he's, that's the way it works. Got in his car and left. So I have in my book several characters that are not by their own names. One of the gentlemen is an old gentleman named Drake. Drake was someone that I actually met as a very young man. Very interesting character. And I'll make a statement here that, you know, it's kind of, I don't know if it'll, what it'll do for my credibility, but this gentleman was the original smoking man from the X-Files. He had been a member of the OSS during World War II and a close aide to General MacArthur. And during World War II, a number of UFOs were either shot down or knocked down by weather circumstances, whatever. But he and MacArthur had viewed some of these crash sites. I forget what he said, two or three. But at any rate, they did view alien entities. And so this is how this gentleman got into this highly compartmentalized area of the CIA. By the way, MacArthur gave a speech to a graduating a group of West Pointers, and wherein he said something about in the future we'll be in a conflict with people from other planets. And then later, a year or so after that, I think he gave a interview to one of the leading magazines of the day talking about the same thing. So anyway, this obviously made a real impression on him. But at any rate, my friend, he was actually the father of a close friend of mine, dear friend. I called him uncle, but anyway. Late in his life, he told me that he was part of a three-man committee that gave the ultimate approvals for black budget projects and the funding. He said one year, the funding request was so huge that the three of them, they just, we can't approve this. You know, we don't know where the money. So they called a four-star general or whoever was in charge of the program. I mean, it was a four-star general. It was in charge of the program or whatever, and said, we can't approve this. It's so much of an increase over last year. We don't know where it's going. You know, there's no oversight. So until we know, we're not going to approve it. So he said they took the three of them to this enormous hangar. And inside the hangar was what he called all sizes of flying saucers. And the general turns to him and says, that's where the money's going. So we had a secret, this was back in the 1964. So we've had a secret space program at least since the 60s. So you're talking 50, 60 years at least.
Easily.
And there's some evidence that goes way before that. But one of the scientists that I spoke with, who officially collected his paycheck from NASA, but a lot of the top NASA people work on secret projects. I mean, that's really what they're there for, what they're paid for. Studied various alien propulsion systems. And I went, so we've been studying back, trying to back engineer stuff since Roswell. He said, you got to understand, it's not all the same. These are, a lot of them use different science, different, you know, than ours. And so it's not like, you know, you figure out one and you understand them all. But obviously we have a space program that's been ongoing for many, many years. And as some of it I could go into, but, you know, we have worked back engineering things. We've had things that were donated to us to work on. And then there's other things that we've actually worked in conjunction with non-humans. So, yeah, there could be a significance to a Lockheed plant nearby, sure.
Absolutely. So for our new listeners, really quick, and then we'll move on. But it's my belief that, so you guys might be familiar with Space Force. Okay. President Trump, while he was in office, introduced something called Space Force. And my belief, and Ken, I wonder if you feel the same way, was that's just their way of slowly kind of admitting that they do have something off planet that they have for a while, but now they're just officially announcing it and they're calling it Space Force. Is that essentially how you feel about it?
Yeah, I think this was a effort to begin integrating some of the secret technology and capabilities we have into, it's a very long public disclosure program that's going on. And I admire the fact that Trump began this process. I think he, you know, and others before him, to give them credit, would have liked to disclose a lot more to the public. But for a number of reasons that some of which I go into and show the pitfalls of in my book. And, you know, there are some pretty powerful people on all three sides of this question. There are forces that want to disclose. I mean, I think you and I and all of our listeners would love to hear all of the truth, you know, we think. And then I've heard some pretty powerful arguments from people who don't want this stuff to go public. They think it poses an existential threat to civilization. I mean, let's just take this one factor. The Middle East is mostly sand and oil. I mean, it doesn't really have a whole lot of that they produce that they can provide for the rest of the world. But yet there's a billion, two or three people there, Muslims, who are pretty dependent upon that resource for their survivor. I mean, to survive, that's the basis of their economy. And what if oil just became worth a nickel a barrel overnight? What do you think would happen, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, and if people really knew everything, there would be a lot of religious people and non-religious people, zealots, all kinds of people would freak out. You know, some would think they're devils, you know, and some would want to worship them. So, you know, those are some of the arguments. Plus, I mean, if we're not the top of the food chain, so to speak, mm-hmm. and there are beings that exist on this planet that have, you know, far greater technology, I think to erode the faith in our government to protect us is a a tremendous understatement. A lot of people say, why would I pay taxes? You can't protect us from, you
know. Exactly. So we don't have to go over this. If you think that we could possibly upset people, by all means, I can edit it out. It's not a big deal. But are you familiar with the acronym EB1?
Only vaguely. EB1 was an extra biological entity that was captured alive, or, you know, what do you want to call it, captured or whatever. But supposedly was maintained for a number of years, and that they did a bunch of interviews with and so forth. I think you had another nickname too, but
Skinny Bob.
Skinny Bob, and I've seen some of the tape on that. It's questionable, but I mean, it's not outside the realm of possibility, because I do know that, you know, from crash sites, there have been entities, both dead and alive. And so, you know, whether this is somebody's idea of the events that took place, or whether it's real, you know, I really haven't analyzed it enough to know.
Yeah, it's hard to really know. I mean, that's one of my favorite pieces of footage. Whether or not it's real, I'll never know. I mean, there's so much technology now, CGI and all this deep fake. It's hard to know what's real and what's not. Another really famous one that I personally believe is real, and maybe it's foolish to believe it, is the autopsy videos. Are you familiar with those?
Yeah, I watched those when they first came out years ago. And, you know, people, God, they analyzed those. It was amazing. Even so far as the, you know, discussion about the clock on the wall and the lighting and the film. They checked the provenance of the film to see if it was from that era. I forget the thing on that. Somebody claimed it was from years later. And so, I mean, I've kind of left that sort of thing behind, because I was able to uncover enough substantial, significant other things that proved to me, at least, what I wanted to find out without having to look at some video to say, yeah, that's real or not. I mean, I can't impress on you enough how much my phone rang. And at some point, I received a call from a gentleman, and this is in the early days of the caller IDs. I had an ad on. I forget what it said, like DOD or something on my caller ID, and I have no idea what this is.
And DOD is a Department of Defense.
Well, no, I mean,
oh,
2008, I didn't know.
No, I'm just explaining to my listeners
okay. I got you. So anyway, and the phone rang all the time anyway, so I didn't pay attention to that thing all the time. So anyway, so I pick up the phone, and the guy says, is it Ken Cherry? The guy's heading up the investigation with the Stephenville UFO mass sighting. And I went, yeah. And he says, hold on just a minute. Let me close my door. And then he goes on to identify himself. You know, he's with an agency and the government, and he has this information he wants to give me. He says, but, you know, you can't use my name and, you know, the source and whatnot. I said, okay. So he tells me the story. And I thanked him, and I went, well, you know, it's a anonymous source I can't use. And, you know, so I don't know if somebody's pulling my leg or not. Well, you know, this happened a number of other times And what was strange is I was getting these stories that if I laid them out in a pattern, there was an intersection. You know, each one, each story was a little bit different, but each one of them had sort of the core point alike, which, you know, unless you've got a whole bunch of different people involved in a hoax against you, you know, the chances are what they're saying is truthful.
Absolutely.
And, right. And some of these were scientists. A couple of them that I did was able to verify their identities. I mean, all I had to do was Google them and find out they were, you know, legitimate, well thought of scientists and so forth, who said they had worked the juxt of a group of these calls was that two of these, well, actually three scientists that I'd spoken with, but two more than occasionally, had worked at S4. Which, by the way, they said these two that I was able to Google and verify and so forth, that they had, I had worked with Bob Lazar at S4. You know, of course, there's always been this big controversy about whether he was, you know, a fraud or whether he actually worked at S4 or any of this kind of stuff. But at any rate, they said their S4, by the way, is part of Area 51 that some people, you know, a lot of people probably familiar with, but in working there, that they were working with anti-gravity equipment, they were back engineering alien technology, and that they had seen Grays there at the facility. So, you know, we're working with alien entities, you know, cooperation with back engineering this stuff, you know, much as Lazar had said. And so, again, developing our own. Now, here's the thing that my mind immediately went to. You know, what part of the people who don't want to disclose is because they want to maintain the control of this technology themselves. They don't want the world to know about it. And that's one of the reasons Ben Rich says, you know, he didn't know if they bring it out to save the world. Mm-hmm. Now think about, you know, back in the 1400s or something like that, the Portugal, Spain, France, England, all four, they were the only ones that could build these massive ships that could sail around the world. And they would come into contact with these lesser developed countries, and they would exploit them, you know, for their you know, commodities, you know, whether it's gold, silver, whatever, you know, tea, mangoes, you know, whatever. And, you know, if they couldn't trade with them, they'd kill them, you know. Well, you think the nature of man has changed any at all? If we've got this safe secret space program, you think they're just flying around in our atmosphere, just, you know, giving people a little thrill, you know, oh, I saw something strange. Hell no. We're out there exploring other worlds, interacting with other, you know, sentient beings, exchanging technology. God knows what they have, you know, maybe life extending stuff. They don't need all of us excess, you know, 7 billion people, you know, they. Why would they save us? You know, they've got this technology. They can fly around all over the place and live this. I mean, what we have in secret is at least 500-year leap of what you and I experience as the pinnacle of technology in the here and now. And I worked on Wall Street with powerful people. And believe me, they don't give a damn about the average person. They do not give a damn about that. I don't care how much they smile, glad hand. They don't care. They don't care. We're just a herd of cattle out here to be, you know, milked, manipulated, and then done away with when the time comes.
That's absolutely, I feel the exact same way. Speaking of cattle, I can't let you go before I ask you about this. So our listeners have been hearing me ramble on and on and on about cattle mutilations. You being a MUFON investigator in the state of Texas, at the very least, even if you weren't there on site, what's your impression of why they seem to be so interested in cattle? And a lot of when they're discovered, there's not tracks leading up to it. There's not blood everywhere. They're very clean, precision cuts. And a lot of times the portion of the cattle that's facing the sky seem to be missing eyes or have their tongue cut out or genitalia. What's your impression of this, and why do they seem to be so interested in them?
Yeah. Well, let me say this. Due to a lot of things that went on behind the scenes, I decided to leave MUFON. There are just too damn many people from too many alphabet agencies involved in MUFON for me. I felt like, you know, I was doing the devil's work for these folks. But at any rate, by turning over cases or helping them, you know, to maintain a platform where the most sensitive cases didn't go out to the, you know, the boots on the ground kind of guys. They went to special groups. But at any rate, another one of the reasons that I left there is because they were not interested in anything except nuts and bolts UFO sightings. And I've always believed that, because I've had a number of paranormal experiences in my lifetime, that a lot of these things, the more I found out and investigated, the more I believed that they were interrelated. So mm-hmm. I think a lot of these phenomena, Bigfoot, crop circles, ghosts, you know, all UFO, that there is some underlying principle, you know, that ties these things all together. So I formed a group called Extraordinary Phenomena Investigations Council, EPIC. And so look me up on Facebook, Ken Cherry, or Epic Voyagers. And we also have a YouTube channel, Epic Voyagers. I have hundreds of videos on there from people like Jim Mars and Tom Moore, Nick Redfern, on and on and on and on. I mean, just, I think you'll really enjoy it. And so the point of EPIC was to investigate all types of extraordinary phenomena. So again, go to my Facebook and, you know, friend me, I'll accept you. But anyway, yeah, so here in Texas, of course, we have had some cattle mutilations. We had one interesting, the latest one we had was on the border, right on the Red River, which is the border between Texas and Oklahoma. And had a call from a gentleman. There was a hay ranch on the Texas side of the river, about 10,000 acres. And they had cattle herd out there, spread out all over the place. So the cowboys, you know, at night, they get on their horse, they got their cell phones, and, you know, go out looking for the cows to bring them in. And so it's a late summer evening, so it's still light later in the evening. And one of the cowboys says, "Did you guys see that strange looking object that just lifted above the tree line?" And he told them where it was. And so they all go converge on it, get there. And they'd all seen this ball of light looking thing, maybe from glint from the sun, but it, you know, right where they found a mutilated cow. So, you know, we have pictures and so forth. And it's exactly as you said, you know, looked like it'd been cut by a laser. No blood, you know, missing part of the jaw, part of the tongue, part of the eyeball, you know, all of the, you know, this stuff. And so, you know, what we do is take a lot of pictures, talk to all the cowboys. They all, you know, they all confirm. So they saw this thing. So I called the sheriff's department there and said, you know, because it's a small community. Everybody knows everybody. And I get a deputy and I said, you know, I told him who I was. We were investigating this cattle mutilation and this ball of light sighting. And I said, do you know these guys? Yeah. Are they credible? Are they a bunch of drunk cowboys playing a no. He said, can I call you back in a few minutes? And I went, sure. You know. So he calls me back about 10 minutes and he's outside the station. He says, I couldn't talk inside. So I just wanted to tell you some of the things that were going on, you know. And it's out there, the country road, no lights, stuff like that, you know, caliche, whatever. He said, we had this one rancher who was going along the road. It was dark out. He said, suddenly the cab of his truck lit up. And he went, what the hell? He looks out the right window, and there's this ball of light following him right along beside him, lighting up the cab of his truck. And then it took off. But anyway, he was saying that, you know, they'd had a number of these things happen where the ball of light had appeared. And he said, right across the river, from where this hay ranch is, there's an Indian reservation. And he said they have a medicine woman there who is kind of like their spiritual leader. And so he gave me her name, and he says she has quite an interesting history. And he said it's related to this. And I went, oh, okay. So anyway, find out from her that ever since she was a little kid, these ball of lights would follow her around. And so, you know, everybody thought this is some sort of a spiritual connection. Who knows? I mean, you know, there's no way for us to verify any of this stuff. I mean, you know, we didn't take a picture of the UFO. Nobody had pictures of the UFO. It's amazing these guys had cameras and they see something. You're on horseback and you're stunned, and then boom, it's gone, you know. And that's why I wanted to check on their credibility. But again, I mean, that hints of more than one, you know, that hints of more, as much of paranormal. So, I mean, in Stephenville, we had two different types of UFOs reported. One was this enormous craft, another was these balls of light. So that would imply that in sometimes the balls of light would be in formation 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or sometimes they would combine into one, or one would turn into several. But, you know, so I guess the press just kind of thought, well, that's the big one is the mothership and these are the scout ships or something like that. So the question is, are all ball of lights, you know, UFO related? Are they supernatural, paranormal, or is the UFO phenomenon partly paranormal?
Yeah.
In other words, is the original place these are from is some other dimension? So, you know, there's a lot of questions surrounding this that obviously are not answered. And even some of the scientists that have worked on some of these projects, a lot of them tend to be so compartmentalized. I mean, it's not like there's a free flow of conversation between them. I mean, there's probably people at the very top, I firmly believe, who see the whole picture and how a lot of the paranormal things that happen are related to the UFO ET thing. So I suspect that there's more than one explanation. And, you know, it makes it fascinating. But the fact is, we already know so much, and we've already developed so much that mankind would take a giant leap forward if they would just make all of this public. There are risks, but you know, a few brave people are trying to bring it out, but at the pace it's going, it's, you know, I don't know if it's going to happen in my lifetime.
Well, I certainly hope it does. I only have two more questions for you. They're a little shorter and they're real easy, but they're very fascinating. I've listened to, honestly, every single interview that I could find of yours. One thing that seems to keep coming up that you seem to be really fascinated with, and I wish more people were. You mentioned the word fleet earlier. Another word for a fleet may be armada, and you might be knowing now where I'm going with this. So a lot of people don't know that at some point in time, I bet you would know the date, something happened, I'll just say it that way, and there was an armada or a fleet of craft that flew over Washington.
D.C., right.
D.C. Was that directly over the White House?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could stand back and you see them flying over the way up in the sky. I had a radio show for about 6 years, and at one point I had heart surgery. So for a period of the time I was recuperating, I had a guest host, and that proved to be so popular that I continued that most of the 6 years. And I was working behind the scenes almost every show, getting either the guest host and or the guests and vetting them and so forth and so on. So I had two witnesses of the 1952 DC flyover, which the only way you could describe it was an armada. I mean, it was a bunch of them. Okay, so one was a woman who's now 60 or so. Anyway, she was a young girl, about, I forget, 8 or 10. Her father was a major who'd been a World War II hero pilot. And this was obviously 1952, is after the war, but he was stationed at the Pentagon. And I guess she said back in those days, they didn't have all the trees and buildings around in the subdivision where she lived. You could practically see, you know, downtown DC. But anyway, so all the kids, you know, used to play outside in those days. And she said, boy, we saw these things and we were screaming, and I ran in and got my dad. And we looked up and he went, oh my God, you know, he's a pilot. He knew every aircraft in the sky, and he called his commanding general, and she said his face just turned white, and he got off the phone and he said, we're not to ever speak of this again. So, and then I had another very elderly gentleman who had been a young analyst at the Pentagon at the time. And he saw these, and then he said he also witnessed jets chasing them. So he was going to give a radio interview. And while he was sitting there waiting, the station manager said, we have just received an order from the president. No one is to mention the jets chasing the UFOs. Mm-hmm. So apparently he went ahead and mentioned this anyway in the course of either that interview or another one. And he said, as punishment, I was sent to South America for 2 years and I didn't even speak Spanish. Went to CIA.
Wow.
And so any rate, that so freaked out the night. And of course, they came up with this ridiculous idea that this was some sort of weather inversion causing this, you know, hot and cold air, blah, blah, blah.
They're good at that, aren't they? Making
well, stuff. Back in those days, you know, the military, the United States military had just saved the world from the Nazis, you know, fascism. And Europe was in tatters. The you know, the military was riding high. Dwight Eisenhower was a god, you know, he was like a god in the country. And so, you know, the government had a lot of credibility back in those days, and they just said, this is what it is. You know, forget what your lying eyes are telling you. There's still videos you can go on YouTube and find of this thing, you know, in color even. Tens of thousands of people witnesses, but they, okay, it was a weather inversion. Well, you don't, you know, you wouldn't get that kind of compliance nowadays. I mean, somebody could censor it, but you couldn't get people to believe, you know, what they'd seen.
Right.
Anyway, so... But that set off a whole series of events.
Similar to the swamp gas thing that happened here in Michigan. It's similar to Roswell was simply a weather balloon. It's called disinformation. They've been doing it forever, and they're
forever.
Unfortunately, they're very, very successful at it. I just got a couple more questions because I know we can't go too long. This one is, have you heard of Planet Serpo?
Yes, I've heard of it.
It's about 14 light years away.
You know, I really don't have any information in that. That's not something I've ever looked into. I know, what is it, Corey? Forget the gentleman's name who was supposed to have been involved in the plan, in the whatever it was, the project. Has videos on that on Gaia, G-A-I-A TV. It's a subscription that if any of your listeners have Gaia, you can search Ken Cherry. And there's an excellent interview that I did there with Gaia. It's an hour long. And I know that you could search the subject of Serpo, and there's a couple of good discussions on that too. But no, I'm not really familiar with it.
Oh, no worries. I here's the last one, and then we'll put a button on this. I of course know the answer to this, but I think my listeners would really love to hear this story. And probably, perhaps, I would assume the reason that you got into MUFON to begin with is your sighting. Do you care to share that really quick? When you were a child?
Yeah, sure. We lived on a ranch that's now it's a built-up middle-class suburb of Dallas, but back then it was very thinly populated. And of course, in the early 50s, kids, you know, they could be outside all day long. Their parents never worried about them. You know, it's like, come home, you know, for dinner. So anyway, I was out walking around through a heavily treed area with my dog. And I walk into a clearing. I look up in the sky, and there's a silvery object just kind of going slowly across the horizon. And back in those days, I mean, you know, I was a country kid. I didn't see any airplanes and everything. I think my grandfather's neighbor had a crop dusting plane or something. That's the only aircraft I'd ever seen. But anyway, I didn't know what this thing was. And next thing I know, there's another craft coming from a much higher altitude, you know, practically in a nosedive toward this thing. And, you know, before I know it, the cockpit, you know, the pilot bails out of the plane that's headed toward the silvery object. And then the smoke starts billowing out of the plane. I had seen something. I don't know if it's the glint of the sun between the silvery object and the other craft or what, you know, if there was any exchange. But anyway, later turns out that this was a 1952 something or other, a jet aircraft. There was a naval air station next to a defense plant about 15 miles away from us. I assume that's where it came from. But anyway, the airplane crashed, and you know, the silvery object had just took off, shot across the sky. And when my parents would get together with neighbors, the only thing they talked about, you know, was rescuing this pilot from the trees, because when he had come down, the parachute got hung up in the trees. And apparently, I mean, it was so thinly populated out there, nobody else apparently saw the UFO. So that I was back during, I think there was still an order to pilots to try to get these craft to land or shoot them down. And there was a, I'm trying to think of his name, General Benjamin Chidlaw, back in 1953, gave a Time magazine interview where he said at one point we're losing a plane a day in encounters with UFOs.
Wow.
You know, some place in the world, you know, where we would encounter UFOs and try to force them down. So obviously trying to force them down or shoot them down didn't work out too well for us. And so they finally rescinded that order. I think that had originated with Truman, you know, all the way back then. So, and I'm sure that came from MacArthur telling him, hey, you know, he probably, I'm sure MacArthur filled in Truman about the downed UFOs and things that they had viewed during World War II. And so they finally lifted that order. But again, that was like something that you see a car wreck or there's carnage or where were you when JFK was assassinated? One of those things, events in your life that you just don't forget.
Yeah. So if we exceed more than 11 minutes, Skype will automatically stop recording. So really quickly, if you don't feel like sharing this, Ken, by all means, you can say no. but you and I shared a very, very similar experience. Do you mind if we go over this real quick?
No, that's fine.
Okay. So my listeners know that I had an experience happen to me when I was 20 years old. If you want more information on it, it's our very first episode. And I shared that conversation with author Geraldine Sutton Stith. But Ken, you had a very similar situation. Would you care to share what happened?
Well, I've had several, but one of the first and most startling things, I was a young Marine going to avionics school in Jacksonville, Florida. My wife was pregnant with our first child. And it was very rough. I mean, financially, it was tough getting by. My wife was away from home, you know, experiencing her first pregnancy. And, you know, her olfactory senses were going nuts. Everything smelled in Jacksonville. And humidity, blah, blah, blah. She was very unhappy. So one night she's on the other side of the bed, turned with her back turned against me. And I'm on my, all the way on the edge of my, practically on the edge of my side of the bed. And I'm laying there and suddenly I felt someone sit down on the edge of the bed. This is late at night and my heart started racing and I was in a cold sweat. And I heard this voice in my head, cleave to thy wife. Now, I probably went to Sunday school three or four times in my life, and I never really got into organized religions. For that could be for a whole nother show, but at any rate, cleave to my wife was as for if you could have been speaking Greek. But at any rate, I guess I got the gist of it, and I scooted over next to my wife in the bed, and I put my arm around her, and suddenly I felt her just exhale, just like a release of tension in her body. And we both fell into a deep sleep. Well, you know, it wasn't till years later that I shared this with my wife. And she said, well, I didn't tell you either, but in that same apartment, one day I thought I was going to lose the baby. She was about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months pregnant. And she said, she started kicking and shaking, you know, and I felt ill and like, having contractions and so forth. So I went in and I laid down on the bed and this presence appeared at the end of the bed. And suddenly she said, I just felt calm. And the baby stopped kicking and I fell asleep and I felt fine afterwards in the same apartment. So, you know, I sometimes am upset at the mundane life I've lived, how little I've achieved, and, you know, what's the kind of, I don't know, it's such an ordinary life as I'm coming toward the end of it. But one of the things that's really kind of helped me and made me feel better about it is somehow this ordinary young kid and his wife and child meant something to this loving entity who literally saved my child's life and possibly my wife's and most certainly our marriage, because if she had lost the child, if she had lived, I'm sure that'd been she'd have gone back to Texas and that'd been the end of it, you know. 52 years later, you know, I nursed her for 10 years before she passed. But, you know, there is something extraordinary that we as human beings can't be completely aware of. You do realize that the human eye can see less than 1% of light.
That's less a great point. That's a great
and point. The human ears are limited to a very small range of hearing. So all of our senses are fine-tuned to operate within this very small parameters. And so there could be things going on all around us that we're just not aware of, you know? And, you know, I don't know. God loves us. Somebody loves us. You know, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't the case. So, you know, some people think we're an experiment by some higher being. Call him God. I don't know. I think by definition, God must be an alien. There, that'll upset everybody, right?
Well, we couldn't leave without upsetting everybody. Trust me, I do it on a weekly basis.
All right.
So, man, that's absolutely fascinating. And really quick, I did want to share with you, too, that not only did I have something come into my room twice in 1 week before I turned 21, by the way, but it did sit on my bed twice. This one I don't share, and I'm probably going to edit out. But I had a telepathic thought voice in my head one time during meditation. And the thing was, is it wasn't in English. I was basically in meditation in my head asking who I was and why I was here and what came back. And it scared me so bad I haven't meditated since, was a Adome. And I assumed it was spelled A-D-O-M-E. I researched it for weeks on end, and then I finally gave up and convinced myself that I had made the whole thing up or something. I thought I was going crazy. And then I thought, well, why don't I try A-D-O-M-I? I might have that backwards. I believe what actually came up as something was A-D-O-M-E, and it turned out to be a singular form of the Edomites. And the Edomites were people who lived in Jerusalem who were kicked out because they worshipped a different god.
Yeah.
So I thought that to be very fascinating.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if it means anything, but Ken, you've been so gracious with your time. You are an outstanding source of knowledge, and I was really, really happy to be able to talk to you. Maybe one day in the future we could have you back on. That would be amazing for me. I'm not sure how often you like to do these things, but there's so much stuff that I wrote down pages for you, like, of stuff I wanted to mention. You know, we didn't get to talk about how you got threatened by the government after the release of your book.
Oh, yeah.
That happened multiple times and it sounded terrifying, really. And we also didn't get to touch on a few other weird ones. Like, have you ever heard of Operation Starfish Prime?
No, I mean, I've heard of it, but I can't recall the details of it right now. But
briefly, it was just, it was during all of our nuclear testing that we were doing, and my grandpa was a part of, unfortunately, he wasn't doing the testing. He was in the pits, essentially. And him and his whole entire platoon died within, I don't know, 8 to 10 years of them doing that. From radiation, of course. Mm-hmm. Operation Starfish Prime was, this is public knowledge. This isn't some weird conspiracy stuff, guys. You can Google this and you're going to find a lot of information on this. Our government was not only testing nuclear warheads in deserts, on sand, in oceans. A lot of people don't know that they did that, but they were exploding them in our upper atmosphere. That's what they called Operation Starfish Prime. And a lot of people believe that that's why. I mean, this might sound crazy, but look it up. This is public knowledge, guys.
A lot of people got thyroid cancer and such from those experiments, you know. Mm-hmm. My thyroid stopped working. But at any rate, the government has done a lot of things that have just unbelievable, and then covered it up, of course. When you mentioned and this is kind of, I figure you'll edit it out, when you mentioned going into meditation, that reminded me of my good friend Tom T. Moore, M-O-O-R-E, and Tom has a daily meditation session where he communicates with his guardian angel. And his guardian angel, I forget his name, answers questions that Tom has a newsletter. He's written a number of books about his guardian angel and some of the things and the things that his guardian angel has introduced him to. Mm. And of course, he gets into reincarnation, past lives, future lives, weather changes, you know, political stuff and whatnot, UFOs. You might want to give him a call.
I would absolutely love that. Maybe I can get that information. If you think you'd be up for it, I am very, 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 very much interested in consciousness, past lives, reincarnation.
Yeah. Well, according to Tom, we don't always incarnate backwards. So we can reincarnate into the future. So
interesting.
Since time is a loop or whatever, I mean, it doesn't exist. So you can mm-hmm. pop up anywhere. But and he also has a newsletter where I think one of the things that he talks about is most benevolent outcomes, where you're asking your guardian angel to arrange the most benevolent outcome, not to the detriment of somebody else. Like you're going through a parking lot, and there's no parking spaces. And, you know, instead of being angry at somebody who's, you ask for a most benevolent outcome, and just as you're pulling up, somebody's pulling out, and they're, you know, they were leaving anyway, and you got. So I guess, but anyway, he has people who ask him for, people to ask for a benevolent outcome for cancer patients, someone who's seriously ill, whatever. But he has quite a following, so you know, you might want to. And I forget how many books he has, like 3 or 4, but fascinating, fascinating guy. I interviewed him. I think he was my first interview on my radio program 10 years ago or more. And I used to have him hosted my program. And of course, I have videos of him on my Epic Voyagers YouTube channel. So,
wow.
Sorry, I should have plugged my stuff more during your broadcast here, but anyway.
No, you were fantastic. Honest to God, Ken, it's not an exaggeration when I say this. I was thrilled to have met you. You seem, your retention for information is unbelievable. I'm 36 and seriously, I'm 36 and I don't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday. So like, for you to have remembered
all
this.
For me, that's easy. I have the same thing for breakfast every morning just to make it easy.
Oh, there you go. Maybe I should start doing that. But it was a real honor to meet you. And I really mean it. It would be a lot of fun. You know, if you ever get bored and you want to do this again, I would love to educate our listeners. It seems like you're just like a big old book of knowledge. So
I've been called other things too. So. All right, Jake, it's been fun. I appreciate it. Give me edited copy and we'll post it on a Facebook page. You know, I used to have a young man who posted my videos and things on my YouTube channel, and he went off on his own and became, he's kind of a, thinks he's a celebrity now. I'm just messing with him. Anyway, maybe you can help me figure out what's sticking on my YouTube channel too. What I usually do with the audios is just put some pictures on there, you know, so they'll know who's talking. But anyway, we can figure all that logistic out later. The Facebook page would be the easiest one. So anyway, been fun. I enjoyed it. So hope we can do it again sometime.
Yeah, it was a real blast. And as soon as I do have it finished, it usually takes 3 to 5 days to edit, depending on how many interviews today. I have another interview I got to do tonight. So busy. But real fascinating conversation. You seem like a really great guy. And I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I'm going to reach out to you. I will text you after this, okay?
Okay. Take care.
You too.
If you guys enjoyed this episode, check out last week's episode. It was really, really good. I worked really hard on it. If you like this one, you're going to love that one. Also, check out our other podcast, Brain Matter. It's just me and my buddy interviewing people who we think are really, really fascinating. And if you guys want to help, the best way that you could do that is by leaving us a 5-star review. It's really easy to do. You just click the 3 little dots on the page next to the bell and leave a 5-star review. Guys, it helps us tremendously. Also, that little bell thing, if you click the bell, that just means that like you're following us and you'll never miss an episode. Thanks, guys.